May the words of my lips and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Among the obscurer and stranger branches of late antique and medieval theological speculation is the quote-unquote science of angelology, the study of angels and their rankings in heaven. Christian tradition, based on sources like Daniel and Ezekiel, Isaiah and the Gospels, and Paul's writings and the book of Revelation, plus a fair amount of oral tradition and highly imaginative speculation. Christian tradition has it that the angelic population of heaven is ranged into 9 groupings of angels called choirs. Each choir has its own rank, purpose, physical or at least visual attributes, and dignity. At the very top are the seraphim, head and shoulders above the rest. They have 3 pairs of wings, one to cover their eyes in God's presence, one with which to fly, and one that they use to cover their bodies. Their wings may or may not be covered with eyes. If you see them in art or in windows, they will probably look like just a head with wings around them. They tend God's throne all day, say the medieval scholars, and all they do is shout praises to God. Holy, holy, holy are you, O Lord, they say all day long. Seraphim means the shining ones. They are so bright, they say, that even the other angels can't look at them. You can see one artist, strange but delightful version of a seraph in the window above the great wooden doors in the tower entry as you leave the church today. Next, just below them come the cherubim, who are not fat babies. They are considerably creepier than babies. They have 4 faces, one of which is a human face, one of which is the face of an ox, the face of a lion, and the face of an eagle, which just happen to correspond to the animals used to represent the writers of the 4 Gospels. Cherubim have 2 pairs of wings, totally covered with eyes. Cherubim serve as guards. The first book in the Bible tells us that God put cherubim at the entrance to the Garden of Eden after humanity was kicked out of the garden. Legend has it that cherubim ring the throne room of God, not letting anyone pass without God's permission. Just below the cherubim come thrones, who, unlike the others, have almost no anthropomorphic characteristics. Picture a wheel covered with, you guessed it, eyes. Picture another wheel inside that wheel at right angles to it, covered with also eyes, so that the throne can travel in any direction it wants. That's all it is wheels of eyes. Cherubs use thrones like cars. They're their transport. Nobody knows where cherubs need to go, why they need to drive anywhere. I'm sure they have errands like the rest of us, but that's what thrones are for. Now, for the next few choirs below thrones, things get a little bit murky. Different authors have different orderings. They call these different choirs different things and say they have different jobs. But here's my best shot at telling you what they are. Next come the dominions. Dominions look like beautiful human beings with wings. From here on down, almost all the angels look pretty much like you and me, but with wings. Their job is to be in charge of all the different nations of the world. Just below them are the virtues, who, depending on who you ask, are either in charge of the movements of the celestial bodies or are in charge of imparting their own namesakes, the virtues, to humans, or maybe they're in charge of both. You can see some of them up there to your left in the round windows up at the top. Next are the powers, or the authorities. They serve as warriors. In Christian mythology, Satan may or may not have been the chief of the powers before he rebelled against God and fell, so they say. Next are the principalities, who often wear crowns and carry scepters. They work with the powers. They carry blessings to the world. They are sometimes said to be a source of inspiration, sort of like a muse. Finally, we come to the lowest 2 of the choirs, and therefore the ones you are likely to know best if you have ever met an angel, and if that meeting was not the result of a mistake with your meds. This is probably who you met. First, we get to the archangels. They are the second to last group. They look like especially beautiful human beings. You can't tell what sex they are, but you can tell they are human and they are gorgeous. They have wings. Archangels are in charge of being guardian angels for different peoples. You might know that Michael is said to be the guardian angel for the nation of Israel and for the Church of Jesus Christ. Archangels are also sent when there's an especially important message that must be delivered. You know that Gabriel is said to have come to the Virgin Mary to announce Christ's impending birth. Last and least, in terms of stature, though not number, are just the regular old angels. They're said to look pretty much like archangels, but also pretty much like us, so much like us, in fact, that you might not know it's an angel you're talking to if you're talking to one. They often show up in hosts, like this host making the annunciation to the shepherds up behind me. They are the least otherworldly, the most thisworldly of all the angels, and therefore they're the best suited to interacting with the likes of you and me. Their name comes from the Greek word that means simply messenger, for that's what they are. Their job is to bear messages to the created world from the divine realm. Now, trying to order the seraphim, cherubim, thrones, dominions, virtues, powers, principalities, archangels, and angels in their ranks may seem to you like just so much silly speculation, that from here there's no place to go but to ask how many of these choirs can dance on the head of a pin. And you're right, this sort of thing can obviously get out of hand quickly. But what this sort of speculation does do is this. It communicates a trust that God has ordered heaven and earth aright. That there is some sort of plan for the world. That there is a system at work here. That at least some of God's ways are knowable. That most importantly of all, the bases are covered. And the jobs that need to get done will get done. But here's what I don't understand. It seems to me that in their wisdom, or lack thereof, those medieval scholars left an entire choir, God's most important choir, out. So God comes to Jeremiah, right, and tells him that he has been chosen to be a prophet, a messenger, an angel to the nations. And Jeremiah balks. He demurs. He fears for what the people will do to him. He worries about what they will think of him. He thinks himself unequal to the task that God has set for him. He seems to think it's the kind of job that should be given to a celestial being, not to an earthly one. But God doesn't think so. God thinks that he's just the one for the job. God says, Jeremiah, of course you're unequal to the task I have set you, but you are not alone, and I am not unequal to this task. With my help, God says, with my help, Jeremiah, you will turn this world upside down, which is to say, you will turn it finally right side up, my side up. Have no fear, Jeremiah, says God. Jeremiah was called to do what he was called to do during a particularly difficult time in the life of Israel. The kingdom was divided. Powerful neighboring nations swept through the land in wave after wave of invasion. The Assyrians, the Egyptians, the Babylonians all took their swipes at Israel, culminating in a great siege and the fall of Jerusalem itself in 587 BCE. The city was destroyed. The temple was leveled and its treasures carried off into far lands. The leaders of the nations were deported. There was every reason to think that the great project that God and the people had been about for so long would fail, that the name of Israel would become a byword and a warning, the name of Yahweh would be forgotten forever, and that the promises of God would fail. Into this mess, God sent Jeremiah. We call him a prophet, which is true, but you might also call him an angel, a messenger who bore words of hope and tidings of return and the promise of restoration and fulfillment. He didn't think he was up to it, but God did, and God helped. And here we are, millennia later, reading his story and his words and talking about them, which means, I think, that God's plan worked. Now, before we go on, I need to use a word. It's a controversial word. It's a word that some consider to be a swear word. It's not to be uttered in polite society, and certainly not from the pulpit of a great church as illustrious as this one. It will make some of you angry. It will make most of us, and I include me in that, uncomfortable. I'm sorry to do it, but it has to be done, and so here I go. Evangelism. Do you feel that queasy feeling right here? Evangelism. Do you feel it? If I'm not mistaken, that queasy feeling you're feeling, that's the feel of crudely drawn cartoon tracts telling you you're going to hell if you don't do what the lady handing them out on the street corner tells you to do. If I'm not mistaken, that's the feeling of opening your just knocked upon front door to find a freshly scrubbed 19-year-old with carefully parted hair and a conservative tie and a great big smile. If I'm not mistaken, that feeling you feel down here is what that terrible and silly question, "Have you been saved?" feels like. If you feel a mite queasy when I use that word evangelism, there's probably a good reason. It's probably because you've had someone do it to you in the past and it hasn't felt very good. It's probably because those who have done it most and to some degree most successfully have had an understanding of our shared tradition very different from your own. And, most regrettably of all, it's probably because we in liberal, progressive churches like Old South have not been using the word or doing the deed for a long time now. We have somehow managed to convince ourselves that our wide open doors are enough, that all we have to do is open them wide enough and then sit in here and wait, and the world will be saved by coming to us. But here's the thing. There's a whole world full of people out there who feel as if someone has marched into their lives, has invaded their lives, and carried the good stuff off into exile. There's a whole world full of people out there who stand in the wreckage and wonder what happened, who stand in the piles where their temples and their hopes and the places of their meeting God once stood, and feel as if their names will become a byword and a warning, and who wonder whether the promises of God have failed. They're not going to come into this place on their own. They're not going to come into this place on their own because they think they know what they will find if they walk in here. Because they have been in other churches where they have been told that they are not welcome because they are gay, or because they are women who have something to say about God, or because they insist that science and logic and intellect have a place in the church. They have walked into other churches and heard hateful words. They have walked into other churches and found museums. They have walked into other churches and met people who bear the name Christian who have told them that they are going to hell. They have met others on the street corners or on their own front porches or at work who have told them that they are outside the promises of God, and they have believed it. There's a whole world full of people out there who don't know that the promises of God still hold. That hope is not a silly thing, even in this world, that love is winning. There are people out there who don't know that church can be this good. Who don't know that there are Christians who are trying this hard. Who don't know that there are Christians who are trying to do it the way we're trying to do it. There are people out there who have heard Pat Robertson preach, but who have never heard a sermon like the one that Nancy preached last week. And how will they ever, unless a messenger comes to tell them about it? Good news. God does have a plan for dealing with this. There is a system at work here. There are beings, not heavenly ones, but earthly, who have been called to bear the message to the nations. And while you may not like it any more than Jeremiah did, you know who they are. You don't have to stand on street corners. You don't have to knock on doors. You don't have to be preachy or creepy. You just have to be you. And you just have to be unafraid. If you need to leave work right at 5 to get to Bible study, don't tell your boss you have errands to run. Say where you're going and do not wince. If your friends want to know why you can't stay out late on Saturday night, be bold and tell them what you're going to do the next morning. If your friends despair over Haiti, tell them that you know a people who don't feel helpless because they are helping right now. If they seem surprised that somebody like you goes to church, well, then you tell them that they ain't seen nothing yet and invite them to come with you. Trust that you are a good and a normal and a high-functioning person. Trust that when they find out the truth about you, that you are a Christian, trust that they will not think you're less cool for going to church. Trust that they will think that church is cooler because you go there. If they ask why you're as good or as kind or as peaceful or as hopeful as you are, tell them what you know about God. If they are broken or beat down, tell them what you know. God will give you the words. That's what evangelism is. The world is in need of faith like the faith that we have here. The world is in need of places and people like Old South Church in Boston. The world is in need of God, and God has a message for the world. Buried right in the middle of that word, evangelism, is another word, angel. It is no accident, either of etymology or of meaning. To do evangelism means simply this. It means to accept the call to be God's messenger, to bear the word of love to a tempestuous, broken, and a beautiful world. It means simply this, to be an angel. So, because I believe that God has ordered the heavens and the earth aright, because I believe that God has made a plan for the world and made provision for its saving, because I believe that the people in this place have true things to say to the nations and that the nations need to hear it, I propose this, a tenth choir. It'll go like this. Seraphim, cherubim, thrones, dominions, virtues, powers, principalities, archangels, angels, and you. So may it be. Amen.